Stephanie, are you going to swear this week?
Probably.
Liel?
I swear I probably will.
All right. Well, you have it straight from the mouths of babes.
Please don't call Liel a babe. That's very objectifying. He does not like that.
Kind of harassing.
Straight from the mouths of marathon finishing, cat owning.
Yes.
Sweater normative podcast host that there may be obscenity. So you may want to send the kids out of the room.
So hold on. So so what you're saying here is that you have like a weird fantasy life that involves like cockapoos and like, oh my God, if only you were a hypoallergenic.
No. Archie's all the dog I need.
My.
Hello, J. Crew. This is Unorthodox, the world's leading Jewish podcast. Though I was just at the General Assembly where somebody queried me on that. I was at the Jewish Federations of North America General Assembly. Someone said, do you really know that you're the, like, what about this podcast from?
Excuse me, are you really the world's leading Jewish podcast? Because metrics show that there is a podcast in Israel that has 300
more. That was exactly
more.
It was exactly it. There's something in Israel. Well, to be fair, Israel story, which we love. But
to me, when you say the world's leading Jewish, to me, that's obviously hyperbolic.
It's qualitative as well as quantitative.
And didn't you say you were just going to say it and see if anyone pushed back on it?
And you were asked this question by, objectively, the world's most boring man or woman.
Most annoying human being. Anyway, right. I'm going to keep saying it, and they can come for us if they have a problem. I'm your host, Markenheimer, joined this week by Tabloid senior writer Liel Leibowitz.
Hello.
And deputy editor Stephanie Butnick.
Good day.
This week, our Jew, besides us, our Jew of the week, our special Yud of the week is the great Eddie Portnoy, whose new book is so good. It's called Bad Rabbi and Other Strange But True Stories from the Yiddish Press, and it's
got that seedy underbelly of
and
of
if I may, Eddie's hair puts mine. Your hair and mine to shame.
What about mine?
I think he might. I think he will be the finest haired individual in the room today.
Our Gentile of the week is Washington Post religion reporter Sarah Pulliam Bailey, who's a favorite of mine. I've followed her stuff for years. She was raised super evangelical. I don't know if she would ascribe to that, but that's how I stereotype her. But she works for the vast liberal media conspiracy.
Super evangelical, like it's Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah,
extra.
It's like the new game.
There were capes involved, but she now works for the liberal media conspiracy at the Washington Post. So we're excited to have her as well. But first, some news of us.
What's with your voice? You talk too much?
Two transcontinental flights across to the GA in Los Angeles. One done at 5 a.m. on Friday. The other red-eyed back Sunday night.
Wow.
And then I talked the whole time in between.
And on the flight, too, I imagine. You're like, some person sitting next to me, I'd like to tell you about my experience.
I hope I get nodules or nodes like the rock stars so I can go in for surgery.
Like I'm pitch perfect?
Yeah.
I have nodes.
And be out of commission for a while.
That is how I feel when, like, that scene of I Have Nodes is me, because I haven't really told you this. I have nasal polyps for like the past, it's been discovered recently. And so it means I get sick very often. I have these like lingering colds that last like a month and I feel congested. I feel awful. I'm actually getting sinus surgery this Friday. So the day after this episode airs, I will be going under general anesthesia.
General?
Yeah. I've never done it before.
Oh, I have.
I've done it before. That recreational general anesthesia. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but part of it...
I hope it's a leading ear, nose, and throat doctor.
Yes. His Yelp reviews are wonderful.
Jewish, I hope.
No.
What? You're going to get a Gentile
doctor? Dr. Prasad is very, very highly recommended.
Oh, Prasad. Okay.
Prasad is the new Cohen.
That's
We're fine. As long as it's not Smith.
Right, or McGillicuddy.
So when I was meeting with
something.
Him, you guys, he was like, oh yeah, and so then we're going to do this. We're going to fix your deviated septum because it's pressing down on something and there's an air pocket. And I was like, I'm sorry, what now? He's like, your deviated septum. And I was like,
that's a real thing?
I was like, that's real?
we should explain for our Gentile listeners the significance.
It's a euphemism, essentially,
right.
That like Rachel from Friends had a deviated septum and then got a nose job.
Right. But when a teenage girl goes in for her deviated septum, she comes out
with a different nose.
With a different nose.
She's precious. Do you ever worry that she's gonna get your real nose? Amy?
Yes, I do. I really do.
And so for me, at age 30, to suddenly hear I have a deviated septum is quite bittersweet. And I also said, what? We'll talk about this like on the nose job episode, I think, because I'm essentially getting a non-nose job.
Right.
And I said, is that going to change my nose? And he's like, no, I tell everyone for better or for worse, you're going to look exactly the same as you did before. And then I'm like, so it's all a lie? Yeah. And he's like, I can't have this conversation with you right now. I'm like really busy. But I'm so fascinated if even a plastic surgeon can fix a deviated septum, because that's on the inside. Anyway, we'll see.
Beauty is on the inside.
Though plastic surgery, nose jobs, I recently learned they do go in through the inside,
they
right?
Do.
I always wondered, how do they not have scars? How do they suture
gonna,
it up so perfectly?
It out.
I think it's done from the inside.
But I'm essentially getting like an anti-nose job,
They're going to fix everything on your nose.
After all this time. Well, I'm like, guys, I'm comfortable with myself now. It's fine.
You know, I think our listeners deserve the truth. The truth is that Stephanie has gotten too big for the podcast. She's moving on to NPR.
Oh, NPR.
And TV.
And I need to get my polyps out.
And we just need like someone else, but we're doing this thing that they do in soap operas. Like, oh, look, the character had like an accident.
Is she going to die?
Oh, I'm dying in surgery. Thank you.
She's dying in surgery.
No, what I mean is you'll come back and you'll sound completely different.
Oh, I'll be like the new.
Like, oh, it's because surgery's
it'll
like,
be like, Darren,
hi, I'm Stephanie Botnick. Here in the studio.
I'm actually
how are you
Gilbert
doing?
Gottfried. I'm coming back as.
Yeah. It'll be
I am Stephanie Botnick.
I'm requesting that voice.
I have nothing to touch any of this, except to say that I was at the General Assembly of the Jewish Federations of North America, the GA of the JFNA in Los Angeles, which was just great. I just want to give a shout out to the fans who came up to me there. Leah Paz, whom we've given a shout out to on our show,
was there.
And Keith Kravitsky from Jersey gave me a nice handshake when I was in line for an espresso at the little coffee bar.
So he recognized you.
My voice or me, or maybe my name tag, if I'm going to be quite frank. anyway, so shout outs to the people, to the unorthodox fans, the J. Crew who were at the GA. It was a lot of fun. So away from the GA of the JFNA and into News of the Jews, Ali Raisman was on 60 Minutes the other night talking about how she was, like many other American female gymnasts, sexually abused by Dr. Larry Nassar, who may be one of the worst people in the world. And we just want to give a shout out to tremendous Jewess and gymnast as well, Ali Raisman, and just thank her for the courage it took to talk about that. From good people to very bad people, Czech Member of Parliament Jaroslav Stanek said just casually, just in passing, you know, that Jews, gays, and Roma should all be gassed. So thanks for letting us know that evil still walks the earth. Speaking of evil, I'm sorry, I'm starting News of the Jews with all this horrible stuff, but it's been a bad week. There was an English woman, a British woman.
Unlike every other week, which is so cheery.
I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to keep
this
it real here.
This week had assholes who hate the Jews.
Yeah, last night, Sid and I were watching This Is Us, the most tear-jerking show on television. Does either of you watch that?
Of course not.
It's so good.
Yep.
And I was kind of also looking at News of the Jews, and This Is Us already has you prepped to sob about everything. It's so manipulative. And so I was already probably a little teary. And then I come across this headline that we were going to talk about, the 70-year-old Jewish woman who was hospitalized with a concussion because she was bashed in the head, or her head was bashed into a wall by an assailant who yelled out Jid, which is Polish for Jew. And I was just like, 70-year-old woman? I just started sobbing. I was like, really? Find a 70-year-old woman and smash her head into a wall?
I mean, because the record was, you know, better. Earlier on, like babies were nicer
to her. I know. It
is messed up because a 7-year-old woman has like seen a lot of things when it comes to anti-Semitism. And this is in London, right?
Right.
In the UK?
Right. It's in the UK.
To me, just extra sad.
I agree. I just felt like, you know what, asshole? Come for me next time. You can bash my. Well, you and I can sort this out.
Yeah,
but like,
come for me too.
Leave grandma
now,
alone.
If only there was a device that was a great equalizer that a 70-year-old woman could keep in her purse and then, you know, whip out
a life alert
pepper spray
when attacked and put three holes in her assailant.
You want 70-year-olds to be packing?
I want men, women, and children to carry heat. I think every Jew older than 4 should be armed.
Did you watch Broad City? Because you would really
literally
like the Florida episode.
No, I'm 3 episodes
behind. I don't want to spoil anything, but
and was that
Fran Drescher is on it.
Was this the Florida episode or the Florida
it's
episode?
I think actually technically it's the Florida
the
episode.
Florida episode.
Is Fran Drescher caring?
No, yes. But basically everyone else is.
That's
it's
amazing.
Shocking and
with
hilarious.
With that voice, she doesn't need a gun. She's no, carrying. Sir. Her voice is her carrying. Blossom is coming to Hulu, for those of you who were big fans of Mayim Bialik back when she was 12.
That sounds super creeps.
That's
but
not what I meant.
I have to say, I never
think Roy Moore listens to the show,
I was
show,
not
Mark.
Going Roy Moore. I was going Mayim Bialik. She just announced on Twitter that her sitcom is finally going to be streaming for those who want to catch
up. I never watched Blossom, and I only sort of know Mayim as in her like later resurgence as scientist, activist, everything else. So for me, I'm like, maybe I should just watch Blossom.
I will say, so did you get Blossom in Israel?
We did.
Okay, so
it involved a Jew. Of course we got
of course
it.
Right, her parents are Israeli, I believe.
Are they?
Yeah, I think her parents are actual.
Her name is Mayim, so right. She gets
her last name is
Mayim.
Mayim.
Hey.
New FBI stats say that we're still number one when it comes to being victims of hate crimes. Of
what
all,
kind of week are you having?
Yeah, of all religions targeted in 2016, we led. We were subject to 54.4% of hate crime attacks in 2016, according to the FBI stats. We should say that the
take greatest, that Zoroastrians.
That's right. We should say
in
that
your face
the Muslims are catching up. I mean,
they were the fastest growing
they were
population.
The fastest growing population, but
well.
They are not going to catch us.
Yeah, to them we say, you will not replace us.
I have to say though, these two
we are hated by America. Get your own people to hate you.
These studies read like those emails of like, they're only 2% of the population, but Jews are attacked most of all. It's like, why?
Did you know?
They have 47% of Nobel Prizes in physics, but 54% of
Mark,
hate crimes.
You went to Los Angeles, a very sunny, happy place, and came back like a super depressed person,
so
full of just like
so
the worst news.
You should never be allowed to leave the East Coast.
It gets worse. Prince Charles, it turns out. My goodness. The Daily Mail reports, they dug up, it didn't say how, an old letter from 1986.
What is that?
In which, a letter or 1986?
Both.
Okay. In which he said
that a Taylor Swift
album? Taylor Swift prequel. Yeah.
Right,
album.
You too. Prince Charles suggested that, quote, the influx of foreign European Jews, unquote, was a cause of turmoil in the Middle East, and that the United States president had a responsibility to, quote, take on the Jewish lobby. He wrote, quote, I now appreciate that Arabs and Jews were all Semitic peoples originally, and it is the influx of foreign European Jews, especially from Poland, they say, which has helped to cause great problems. Surely some U.S. president has to have the courage to stand up and take on the Jewish lobby in the U.S.? I must be naive, I suppose.
I am a huge fan of the P.G. Wodehouse, you know, Jeeves and Wooster books.
Yeah.
The entire letter reads exactly like Bertie Wooster.
It's Wooster.
It's like, oh, old pal, I was reading the Quran on my flight to Saudi Arabia, and pip, pip, tally ho, won't you know that the Jews came from Poland? Right. Jolly good.
I like this. It's like this so surge amazing. Of Jews coming from Eastern Europe.
And
it's
in
like
1986.
This influx, and you're like, oh, yes, this influx of Jews willingly leaving Eastern Europe.
Well, it's also like he hadn't gotten the memo because, of course, he's not out and about. And so it's 1986, and he hears the Jewish population is bigger than it was in my childhood. So
that's
and
right.
He's like, what happened?
What
like,
happened?
Why did they all
were
leave
any members
one
of my
place?
Family sympathetic to the Nazis? Maybe.
And I feel like I liked Prince Charles. I mean, this is a while ago. We all changed. But he opened, I think, in 2008, the JCC in Krakow, which is like one of the best places and run by a really cool guy, Jonathan Ornstein.
Well,
but he
Jews
was there. Prince Charles was there with
well, the
whatever her name
Jews.
Is. Camilla.
So he's grown with Camilla Parker Bowles.
So
funny story about Camilla Parker Bowles.
Yes, please.
What's the company?
Said no one.
Crate and Barrel sells a set of
said Princess Diana.
Is it Camilla Bowles?
No, they're Parker Bowles. So Crate and Barrel sells a set of nested China bowls that, you know, are good for serving roasted broccoli, pasta, whatever. And we ordered some a number of years ago, and they're called the Parker Bowles. So else we call them the Camilla Parker Bowles.
And on that
which
note,
never fails to crack me
I
up.
Would say to you know, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, anyone who wears bowler hats on a regular basis in the year 2017, unironically, shouldn't have opinions, period,
so
about anything.
I was just, this whole thing made me wonder, like, what was his tutoring like? Because I don't think he went to Eton or Harrow. I think he was stuck with, like, Mrs. McGillicuddy tutoring him. And she was like, our subject today will be polo.
And
backgammon. But there was no world religions hour.
Folding a pocket square. Begin.
He should take a trip to Indonesia, where we also learned this week that a museum has a wax figure of Adolf Hitler set against a backdrop of Auschwitz-Birkenau, where visitors can take Hitler selfies. Damada, a waxwork and visual effects museum in Yogyakarta, has had this up since 2014. The owner of it, or the guy who runs it, the museum's marketing officer, told the Associated Press, nobody's complained. Most of our visitors are just having fun because they know it's just an entertainment museum. Jews are not amused.
I have to say, so in this museum, there's Hitler, and next to him on one side is Darth Vader, and on the other side is the Indonesian president.
That's about
so
right.
So it's like, what? And there's like, Obama's in there. I mean, I think the problem is it's like this like triumphant looking Hitler where he
we won.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, cool. I don't know. I mean,
so
to me,
like,
I'm just
like swagger Hitler.
Yeah, he's in front of the Arbeit macht frei sign. And yeah, it's really bad.
He's flashing gang signs. He's like, whoa,
this
what?
This goes back to one of the things I said on our first show or on one of our first shows where I said, I don't like museums. And I got all that mail. And I was like, see, this like one day it's the Met. And okay, it's like
this
the
is
Egyptian
why we can't
room.
Have nice things.
But when the Indonesians get hold of it, it's like, hey.
One day you're looking at the Mona Lisa. The very next, it's Hitler selfie.
Selfies with Hitler. That's exactly right.
Is he in Madame Tussauds?
Slippery slope.
Is that how you say that?
I believe he is. But
Hitler?
It's a sad, dejected looking Hitler.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not someone you're selfieing with.
Yeah, you can't do triumphant Hitler.
No.
I also think he might be giving a Nazi salute in the picture.
Oh, God.
Do you want to put it's nice. You can kind of get under it.
I was just thinking that you can sort of get it. He's putting his arm around you.
Can like put like a yo-yo on his finger and have a lot of fun.
A fidget spinner.
And finally, Kim Kardashian has invested in a fashion app started by Orthodox Jews from Jerusalem and Brooklyn.
Finally, some good news this week.
Finally, some good news. Liel, you flagged this one for us.
I think this is a you know our senior Kardashian correspondent Stephanie Budnick's territory.
What is this?
This is weird. You actually write about the Kardashians
all the
more
time
than anyone.
I'm completely
obsessed
with her.
So the app is basically like Shazam for clothes. So if I see like you wearing this shirt, or maybe it's something on a mannequin somewhere, but I can like open the app, take a picture of it, and all of a sudden it'll offer me like several different other options of items that match it, of items like it.
The funniest thing about this story is they interviewed the guy who by all accounts sounds like a really lovely, talented guy. He's some, you know, some Haredi guy from Jerusalem. And he said something like, well, you know, Kim isn't just an ambassador of the brand and an investor. She's really involved in the brand. Turns out she knows a lot about marketing. I was like, Yossel, like, dude. You know?
Dude.
The last 10 years have been a pretty strong suggestion that was the case.
You need to get out of yeshiva, my friend.
But I loved how he was like, so like, oh, wow, that wonderful
that Armenian girl, that little Armenian girl with the big butt.
She had a statement that was like, you know, and it's so great that we have this the amazing technology coming from Israel and all this great technology. And I'm like, yep.
Yep.
Can I just say, my Middle East peace plan, and I know Trump has been in the news trying to rejigger
yes,
the peace plan.
Yes, he's writing one right now with his own pen.
I think it needs to revolve, and I am not joking right now, it needs to revolve heavily around Kim Kardashian and Kanye West.
Our Jewish guest this week is Eddie Portnoy from the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research. He's an expert in all things Jewish pop culture, and his new book, Bad Rabbi, mines the strange but true stories from the Yiddish press. Eddie, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
You big Yid.
I'm actually kind of a short Yid.
But you know what I mean.
That's a short Yid, hair.
But you're a big Yid.
It gives you the persona.
So right. I'm happy to have you here in person because like I've known about you for a while. We've corresponded on email. You've contributed to Tablet. I always sort of imagine you like deep in the archives of YIVO. Like I the idea that you're an actual person who is here now is very strange to me.
I always thought it was a pen name. It was like, let's find the most Portnoy. Jewish name we can. Well, I know it'll be funny. We'll take the last name Portnoy, but he's like obviously Eddie Schwarzfeld from Hoboken.
Right. Yeah. Oddly enough, Portnoy is not that uncommon of a name.
Yeah, of course not.
I don't know any Portnoys except you.
It's if you look in the phone book, which I guess no one looks in the phone book.
That's right.
But, you know, if you look online, there are plenty of Portnoys.
My parents' best friends are the Portnoys. One of their best friends. I don't want to
know. Yeah, actually, there are a few more Edward Portnoys. One's a dentist in Queens.
Nice.
There's an Edward Portnoy who's like a gastroenterologist in California.
Nice.
Of course there is.
Eddie Portnoy is very different than Edward Portnoy, though.
Yeah. But it's your real name, you're saying.
No. It's Edward.
Portnoy.
Oh, Portnoy. Yes.
No, it's not. You seem to be one of the... we could talk about your name all day.
And your hair.
And your hair all day. This is that
His
kind of
hair
podcast.
Is very Alice in Chains.
Can you describe it for our listeners?
I don't know what
Alice in Chains is.
It's grunge hair circa 1991.
It's sort of...
Curious now to entertain us.
It's like Rockstar Monkey.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. Yeah. It's like I woke up like this.
Yeah.
Type of hair.
Then he put some shaving cream through it.
All right,
volume.
Guys, let's...
How does one get to where you are? It seems to me like such an amazing niche of like mining all these lost treasures of Yiddish culture. Was this always an obsession?
And your book, we should say, is like crazy
amazing,
tales
amazing,
from the Yiddish
amazing.
Press. It's like gamblers, whores, abortion doctors, circus sideshow freaks from the Yiddish press, 1890 to 1920-ish.
Right.
Yeah.
Thereabouts.
Yeah.
How do you get obsessed with that stuff?
It's not really clear. I guess I've always been attracted to unusual things. And when I got into Jewish studies, that sort of attraction remained. So, you know, when I began to read the Yiddish press, I would really just stumble across these things. I mean, I could actually explain if you want how I found some of them.
Yeah.
Just as an example, I discovered a whole cache of material on Jews involved in professional wrestling in Poland before World War II. My dissertation was on cartoons of the Yiddish press. So I trolled the Yiddish press, obviously, for cartoons. And in the mid-1920s, I began to find cartoons that used wrestling as a metaphor. You know, for example, it would show two cantors that were vying for a post at a big synagogue in the wrestling ring, or two heads of Yiddish school systems in the wrestling ring. And I thought, that's, you know, sort of a stock metaphor, but, you know, what does wrestling, you know, mean?
Why is that a thing for them?
Right. Well, you know, what does it mean to Jews in Warsaw? So, you know, in 1925. So I began to look through the back pages of the papers where they have the results of sporting events. And once in a while, I'd come across, you know, the Jewish wrestler, you know, beat so-and-so, and the notes about the Jewish wrestler. And as I looked more and more, I began to discover articles about these people, and they were celebrities among Jews in Poland. And it was really kind of a big affair. They would pack the Warsaw Circus for the, you know, for the matches. Interestingly enough, the bulk of the Jewish audience that would go to wrestling matches was comprised of Hasidim. When the Jewish wrestler was in trouble, some of the journalists wrote, the Hasidim would all stand up and sing psalms, which, you know, sort of the most Jewish response to, you know, what you, you know, to your wrestler who's in trouble.
Oh my God. And the cover of your book is in fact Blimp Levy.
Right.
With the 600 pounds or 600 to 700. They couldn't find scale. Back in those days when that was an abnormal weight, they couldn't find scales to tell how big he actually was.
Kind of looks like me a lot, I would say.
By the way, this is actually what I decided Eddie Portnoy looked like. The cover of his book is Blimp Levy, who is maybe the ugliest man.
No,
excuse me.
Blimp Levy's adorable.
He's a handsome guy.
All right.
All 700 pounds. Eddie, I have a question for you. We've lost so much, it seems to me, with, you know, advent of Google and the internet, of this art that you're describing, of just, you know, sitting in the archive, poring over the press. Is this something that's ever coming back? Do you get young students who don't even know where to look?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're starting out in this field and you want to research something, I mean, like I said, I found a lot of things by accident. So just as another example, when I was looking for cartoons in the Yiddish press in the Warsaw dailies, cartoons only appeared on Fridays. So I would sit at the microfilm reader and turn the dial and, you know, try to zip from Friday to Friday. And one time I landed on a Thursday, and the headline that I landed on was Two Wives, Blazing Punches, and the Police. And I thought, wow, that's kind of interesting.
I'll read this.
Right, I'll read it. So it turned out to be an article about this Hasidic guy who fell in love with his wife's best friend, married her, set her up in an apartment outside of town, and shuttled between the two women, telling the first wife that he was away on business. And his brother found out about it, set up an appointment at the rabbinical court, dragged him there. At the rabbinical court, there were 30 members of the first wife's family. And when the rabbis announced that he had to divorce both women, his brother ran over to him, punched him in the face. The 30 members of the first wife's family jumped on the second wife. The rabbis ran out. The shamus called the police and arrested everyone and took them to jail.
What you're saying is that Jews used to be fun.
Yeah. Jews used to be a lot of fun. They were exciting people.
Your book is filled with riots.
Yes,
like there's there's the Hasidic, I'm trying to remember, what's the funeral where they turn up and
The Miss Judea pageant.
That's
the denouement of the Miss Judea pageant.
The Polish newspaper decided they were going to like have a pageant for, they were going to find the hottest Jewish woman. And so the Polish newspaper got and it was judged by Jewish journalists.
Right. It's the Polish Jewish newspaper.
The Polish newspaper.
Right. It's a Polish Jewish daily.
Okay.
But from the perspective of the Yiddish press, Polish Jewish daily is
Goyish, basically.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Right. And then at the, there was a rabbi who like dropped dead, the super ultra Orthodox rabbi.
Right.
And they blamed the guy who organized the pageant.
More or less. I mean, they were still mad at him from having, actually, it wasn't that he organized the pageant. It was that he read the winner, the Song of Songs.
And so there was a riot at the funeral.
Right.
Amazing.
So why was the Yiddish press so obsessed with like the failings of its community and just
it wasn't that they were so obsessed with the failings of the community. It's that I'm so obsessed with the failings of the community.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Because when you're, you know, the Yiddish press is a whole universe and you don't just have, you know, stories of failure. You have all kinds of stories. It's like any newspaper. You have international, local, national news, you've literature, crossword puzzles, you know, anything you can imagine that newspapers have. It's just that this element of Jewish life has never really been approached by scholars or really anybody else. You find some of it in literature. Isaac Babel will have written about poor Jewish gangsters, or Isaac Pshevis Singer will have scenes on Krochmalna Street, which is one of the poorest neighborhoods in Warsaw. You know, when you're in Jewish studies, what you find is that it's a very conservative field, that the focus tends to be on traditional figures, scholars, rabbis, writers, artists. There's been...
Very elitist, if you will.
It is. I mean, there's a lot of social history also, but all the social history is upwardly mobile. So having dealt with that for many years and having seen that there's so much of this life in the Yiddish press that hasn't been explored, I thought this is, you know, a really compelling topic. This is, you know, the Amcha. This is the common rabble that nobody really knows anything about. And it was just really appealing to me.
And so what do we need to do to make Jewish press great again?
Oh.
I mean,
what
advice do you have for other publications that are not
again?
Us?
Could it be this fun again?
We don't have enough horrors, I think, these days. And I'm pro wrestlers.
We have a lot of horrible things going on.
But they're like financial crimes. They're not
as interesting.
Fun.
You know, I think at a certain level you have to have an amcha. You have to have, you know, a common rabble. And I mean, that's something you have in Israel. Right. You don't have it as much here. Another aspect to this is Yiddish. The Yiddish press is in a way very intimate. The stories are written often as if, you know, friends or relatives are telling a story to one another. Even in crime stories, you'll hear, victims and perpetrators, right, talked about as Moishele and Yosele, and like they, they don't, it's like they mention their real names at the beginning, right, but then they talk about them like they know them. Right. And maybe they do. It's all about being part of a smaller, more cohesive community. And also another interesting aspect to this is that the Yiddish press in a way is like a private conversation, because
no one else can read it.
Right. Exactly. Because we've let that go and everything's in English, now David Duke can read our articles and flip out, and that, makes us flip out. So it's, having that private, there's something to be said about having that private conversation. So if we were all to learn Yiddish, it would be enormously valuable culturally.
But that would be prioritizing like the Ashkenaz experience. And we would then say, then only.
Well, listen,
the Ashkenormative.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You could have other, I'm not opposed to multilingualism. We can learn Ladino too.
But I just feel like this, what we didn't see in your book is what we see now, which is like this, like the whole like Shonda Fertigoyim, like the idea that we, bad stories about Jews reflect badly on all Jews.
No one could read this shit.
But in the Yiddish press and these stories, they're crazy stories and they're so rich and vibrant, but you wouldn't see them today because the idea is like, why would we write about, he's bad. We don't want other people to know that they're bad Jews.
We'll get Robert De Niro to play him,
Or Joe Mantegna.
Or Joe Mantegna, right. So obviously, if there are all of these, gangsters and hustlers and pimps and whores and everything, some of them had children who are our parents, right? And nobody talks about like great grandma tricking on the side. And so, everyone, great grandma was like the pioneer who founded Hadassah in her neighborhood, and her uncle was the chief rabbi of Vienna, right?
Speak for yourself.
But I mean, so is there just a massive conspiracy of lies for all of us who are descended from, pimps, whores, and hustlers?
Well, listen, I think that, these are things that obviously embarrass people. No one wants to know that Bubby turned tricks, or that Zayn.
Which, by the way, is the title of Eddie Portnoy's next book, Bubby Turned Tricks, Another Family
it's
Story.
It's a children's book.
It's the TV adaptation.
Right. Or that Zadie was a pickpocket. We do certain things to improve our pedigrees. And one of them is hiding things like this. A couple years ago at YIVO, I did an exhibit called Yiddish Fight Club that showed Jewish professional wrestlers and boxers.
This is amazing.
Surrounded by a huge lexicon and list of phrases in Yiddish that have to do with fighting. That was actually part of YIVO's first linguistics publication. But one of the interesting things about it was after the exhibit launched, I had all kinds of people coming to YIVO and calling me and emailing me and sending me pictures of their relatives who were professional wrestlers and boxers. And they would say, you know, it was, I never had a venue to talk about the fact that my great uncle was a wrestler or that my grandfather was a boxer. It's really kind of an interesting element of or component of Jewish history where, you know, people have all of these interesting components of their past and they just don't know how to talk about it.
So, Eddie, before we let you go, what is your favorite story in this book? What surprised you the most?
I have to say that nothing really surprises me in the Yiddish press. It's just this cavalcade of lunacy. But one of the stories I like the most is the story you mentioned before, the Miss Judea pageant, because it involves every precinct of the Jewish community. You have the, you know, the Polish, you know, so-called assimilators, they're Polish-speaking Jews. You have, the Yiddish press. You have the ultra-Orthodox. You have the Hasidim. You have, you know, sort of extremists at all sides converging and, you know, kind of exploding at the end. And it's really, it's a nice story.
There's beauty pageant, there's death, there's riots. It has everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
Eddie, thank you so much for being here. Our listeners can get Bad Rabbi and other strange but true stories from the Yiddish press anywhere. I think books and
fine
and
books.
Fine books.
We're fine
and the Yiddish
books.
Press yeah. are yeah. sold.
You know, maybe not at Eichler's, but, you know. Oh, maybe you can get it at Eichler's.
Eddie, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Our Gentile of the Week is the... is really gentilic. I mean, is Sarah Pulliam Bailey, who's a religion reporter and editor for the Washington Post.
First of all, anyone with two last names is automatically like 5 points.
Automatically,
on the scale.
Yeah, on. Yeah. That's extra Gentile points. But also, you went to Wheaton College, not the former Ladies College in Massachusetts, where fine preppy girls could go for finishing, but the one that has the Billy Graham archives.
Right.
I mean, the real.
The real Wheaton.
Right.
College.
They call it the Evangelical Harvard.
I love that you guys call it that. You know, Harvard doesn't think of themselves as the secular Wheaton.
No, but they should. I'm just kidding.
But it's really Jesus-y there.
Yeah.
And you were homeschooled with 18 siblings, right?
Close. I had 5 siblings, but yes, I was homeschooled, yeah.
But the really interesting thing, so Sarah and I were, I wouldn't say competitors, but I was writing religion for the Times when you were writing religion for the Washington Post, and I always admired her work a lot. But also, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to have you on the show. One is that you're a terrific reporter and you're paying attention to the national religious scene in a way that those of us ghettoized in our little behind our Jewish wall are not necessarily. But also, like, you are, you know, you're that mythical creature of the Christian in a newsroom. And so, you know, we're have you here to prove that they exist.
Right. Oh, dear. Okay. Well, it's funny being a religion reporter. I feel... you know, slightly uncomfortable when religion, my own faith background comes up
because yeah,
I want to, no, I don't mind. Like, I'm happy to talk about it, but I, you know, when it comes up, I want to be like, anyone of any religious background, of no religious background, can be a good religion reporter. It's kind of like sports, you know, you don't have to play to be a good reporter. You can just be a really good observer. So when I talk, yes, I am I have this background. I am, you know, a Christian, but I'm also like, it's okay. it doesn't like infuse into my reporting.
Yeah, but doesn't it blow your mind that so many, and I have, you know, a world of respect for religion writing, which I, you know, consume a lot of.
And you do some of it sometimes.
Yeah, some of it sometimes. Yeah. Doesn't it blow your mind that so many religion writers are like so fundamentally unreligious?
Well, so there are so few of them. There's so few religion reporters. And I...
You mean of the 7?
Of the,
five,
yeah.
Five are
the,
unreligious?
Like, right. There's so few religion reporters. I blame editors who... I don't know, you know, if they don't have a religious background or they just don't care about religion. I feel like there's so few religion reporters to begin with. There are no editors who specialize in it either. My editor is, you know, she generally edits social issues. She doesn't edit religion specifically. So we can, you know, we could have a long conversation. Should you have more religion reporters? I say yes. But most editors would say we should have people who write about politics with religion on the side or education with religion on the side. And I would say, no, you need people who specialize this, who know this well.
But now I imagine everyone's like, wait, religion is important in the past year or so. They're like, I had an editor
tell me like, oh, your beat is like legit now. I was like, this is why Trump won, because you weren't paying attention.
That's right.
You know, so in that sense, like, I think after the election, people are like, Muslim man, oh my goodness, we need reporters who understand Muslims.
Right.
And then, you know, these evangelical supporters of Trump are incredibly influential and unofficial and weird and hard to understand. And so editors are like, we need people who understand them. And so all of a sudden there is a sense of, you know, there's America we don't know, right? And, you know, part of that is the rural, you know, frustrated economic thing. But I think there is a sense of
the people, as someone so succinctly put it once, who cling to their guns and their God.
Exactly. Yes.
Those
yes.
guys. But don't you feel it happens like in spurts? Because I feel like after 9/11, yes. everyone yes. was like, oh my God, Muslims.
That's
you
when
have
I
to
got
understand.
Hired. No, right, that's when I got hired. In 2000, it was like, wait, right. the Catholic Church has all these scandals with fiddling and diddling the little kids. 9/11 and the Second Intifada, all in about an 18-month period. And people said, religion matters. We're going to get some reporters.
And then by 2006,
yeah, no.
It was like,
literally, when I graduated graduate school, and I was like, I love religion. I want to be religion important. They're like, we're actually cutting every religion bureau, and every right. paper except what two? Like, yeah. I studied religion undergrad and graduate school, and it wasn't until I got to graduate school that I realized that Duke had basically been a place where like people thought religion was important, mm-hmm. right? It was mm-hmm. founded as a Methodist school, obviously not really super denominational anymore. But then I got to NYU, and it was a very like critical. Let's look at why people are so weird and like religion,
and how can we cure them?
No, and so I almost realized, oh, I actually was someplace that valued religion, and that influenced everything I learned. And so I'm wondering if that affects you as a reporter, like this idea that religion is important needs yeah. to be in your mind, really.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that a lot of editors think about religion coverage as similar to other beats where you're covering institutions. We need to cover the Catholic Church. We need to cover Pope Francis. We have these individuals and institutions. Whereas I like to think about it as religion integrating into everyday life, whether it's family or business or education. So these religion and politics stories. And I think because I have this faith background, it's so integrated into my own life that I think it's easy to find the other stories as opposed to seeing it as a separate thing to like go cover.
So what's the big story right now? Is it evangelicals and their inexplicable love affair with Trump? Is it, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, there are tons of them. I would say in this moment, in October, the Protestant Reformation 500th anniversary is October 31st, Halloween.
Things our listeners didn't know.
Right.
Things our listeners were not on top of.
Well, so
what are you going as this Halloween?
What am I going as? Yeah. No, actually, so
are you going as like Martin Luther? Or?
I mean, I grew up in sort of an odd family, and we instead of Halloween, we weren't allowed to do Halloween. I've never been trick or treating. We had Reformation Day parties. We didn't go as anything, but we would like go and have these parties.
Wait, was that a Pulliam family thing, or is that an evangelical subculture thing?
I'm learning that some Lutheran families do this too. I grew up Presbyterian, so I didn't grow up Lutheran, but I think it's these people who have like very strong, deep feelings about the Reformation, about Martin Luther.
How do you do a Reformation party? Do you dress like John Calvin?
So my church my church would just throw like a fun party for kids. There wasn't like.
Do you get to nail stuff to the door?
Yeah, like, yeah. Say, I mean, is it like the first kid to get to 95 in some game?
I think it was an out for parents who were like, we don't want to do trick or treating. Can we do something else? Let's just throw the kids in the church basement and let them play.
I'd like to say, and there are Orthodox Jews who don't do Halloween either.
I was just
either.
About to say, we should band together.
I'm going to say this to all of the frummy Jews and all the evangelicals who don't let their kids do Halloween. Equal opportunity disdain for me. Come on. America, this is not a religious holiday. This is just a fun holiday. There's not a kid in the history of the universe who's been drawn to Satanism.
Mark, you're missing
from
the
Halloween. Just let the kids have an American holiday.
You're missing the opportunity here. The point here is that the evangelicals and the Orthodox could now band together to
that's
celebrate
true.
Reformation
they
Day.
Banded together. Last time they banded together. Last time they banded together, we got a president, Liel.
That's kind of true. But think about like the merchandise. Think about the marketing opportunities. The Hallmark Reformation Day cards.
So, I mean, one of the things you hear from a lot of from some religion reporters, especially the two or three others who are evangelical, right? And you and I know who they are,
yeah.
is that newsrooms hate religion and everybody is hyper secular and the hostility runs deep. And has that been your experience at
no,
the Washington Post?
No, I don't
Post?
Think that's fair. I think there's a strangeness to evangelicals, and maybe, you know, rightly so, but I think there's a lot of like lack of understanding, which I would say is generally fine, except that these people make up a quarter of our country. They dominate certain cities like Colorado Springs and Nashville and Grand Rapids. And you need reporters who understand this subculture because it's a really strong subculture and they obviously influence elections. So you need people who get them, whether they're evangelical or not. I would say in the internal newsroom, you have a lot of diversity. You have racial diversity, gender diversity. You're not going to like go find your, you don't go to the newsroom to find your people, right? That's not the point. The point is to be able to, you know, explain a group of people. And for me, it's not just evangelicals, it's Muslims, it's Catholics, it's Jews, but I feel like this is a particular subgroup that I tend to like understand a slightly more than most people.
Are you the most religious person in the newsroom?
No. I mean, someone...
No, Marty Baron sacrifices a goat every Wednesday afternoon. He's Santeria, like hardcore.
No, that is not true.
People know that, but it's fact.
Right. David Fahrenthold is a Zoroastrian, actually.
Well, so someone posted in a Slack channel... the lactation room, like they didn't, they needed a place to go pray. I think they were.
They used the lactation room?
Mm-hmm. So like that is something that I'm like, I have respect for that because you got to go find. So the, sorry, for context, the Washington Post newsroom is full of glass, like glass offices, glass. It's very transparent, right? I think it's meta, but there are very few closed off spaces. Like if you need to go cry, there's no place. Sorry, you're going to do it in the open. So the lactation room is one of the rooms. So
it's one of the few rooms that with
so
privacy.
Yeah. So if you need to go pray, if you're Muslim or Baha'i or something, you know where you go pray. So to that end, I'm like, I have respect for other differences that aren't my own. And in general, I think people love like my colleague, Julie Zosmer. Mm-hmm. This isn't religion, but she makes balloon, like balloon animals and balloon. She's like a balloonist and she makes balloons for everyone.
That's amazing.
You know, and people love that. People love like just sort of quirky, exotic.
It's like some people are Baha'i, some people make right. balloon animals.
Right. Right. Exactly. There's probably people balloons. Listening to us right now in Kansas being like, yep, that's why they lost.
So I was on maternity
That's
leave
right.
during the election last year. So I wasn't doing reporting during the campaign, but my in-laws and my parents both were like, oh yeah, everyone we know is voting for Trump. Like my parents are in Indiana, Mike Pence country. I wasn't surprised by that. My in-laws are in Wisconsin. And when they said their mega church pastor endorsed Trump from the pulpit, I was like, that's interesting. That's weird. Like, well, Clinton's going to win because that's what the media said, you know? So if I feel like if we had more people spread out around the country who understood these communities, maybe we wouldn't
be so
shocked. More
Komavudi religion reporters.
Yeah, yeah.
For example.
Exactly.
So enough of Trump and us in this and Sarah Polley-Belly.
Right. Enough of Trump.
Let's talk about the Jews. Growing up as a religious Presbyterian, what did you think of the Jews?
I don't know if I consciously knew who they were in that. So the stereotype is that evangelicals love Jews because of Israel. I didn't grow up in that kind of church. I didn't grow up in that kind of family. I remember asking my dad about the Holocaust. I remember asking a lot of questions about people who are Jewish, but it wasn't, so now I know other families that have a different upbringing, but it wasn't like a thing either way. It really wasn't until I moved to New York like 5 years ago where I was like, I should learn a little bit more about this.
I should report on these guys.
Well, so before I was at the Post, I was at religious publication, Christianity Today. So I wasn't, when I've been a religion reporter, but I focus more on Christianity. So more recently, obviously I do sort of multi-faith, all faiths, right? But it wasn't, so we moved to New York, we moved to the Upper West Side next to Orthodox daycare.
Know what you were doing? Then I moved to Salt Lake City and there were all these people who didn't drink soda.
Right.
It was the weirdest thing.
I mean, yes and no. I think I was just like, it's a nice neighborhood. New York is, you know, and it was close to where I was working at the time too. So it wasn't just a random neighborhood. But I was learning a lot about, obviously, the holidays. And like our doorman asked my husband when to light the menorah. He was like, I don't know.
It's like, but you live here.
Right.
So we have two more questions for you. The first is, what's your favorite story you've written? If people want to go get a dose of Sarah Polley-Belly, what should they read?
So I just went to Brazil and I wrote about Pentecostalism there, which is sort of charismatic, more emotional Christianity, very focused on health and wealth gospel. So how money integrates with these churches and these pastors, you know, give really strong pitches for give money to the church and God will bless you. And that story should be coming out in the next week or two.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we always give the Gentile of the Week an opportunity to ask us a question. Like, what can we, as your panel of Jewish experts...
By the way, I listen to your show like a lot.
So
I'm a huge fan. So I was prepared for this question.
Okay.
So I have an 18-month-old and I'm thinking she's like entering into terrible twos soon and we're thinking about discipline. How are we going to do this? So Anyway, I'm curious, like, with Jewish culture and traditions, like, are there any Jewish parenting tips that you can
guilt,
offer?
Guilt. A whole lot of guilt. Be like, that's okay. Awesome. You could throw a tantrum.
Awesome.
Is that, I'll just sit here alone
is that
in
your,
the dark.
Is that your serious answer?
No.
What's your serious answer?
I don't know that I have a serious answer. I don't know that I'm ready
Mark
to comment
has an answer.
On parenting.
Okay.
I only have two kids. You have four. You go.
All right. Well, the first thing I'll say is this is a really nice chance for me to give a shout out to a great book, which is there's actually a book about this. Well, there's a couple. There's Marjorie Ingle's book, Mamala Knows Best,
great
which
book.
Is a great, great book. And that's more, I think, for sort of the whole journey of parenting. But for younger kids up through, you know, for sort of the first half of the childhood journey, The Blessing of the Skinned Knee by Wendy Mogul is kind of like a classic. Like if you're a Jew and you're having kids, somebody will give you a copy of that. And it's basically about self-sufficiency. Actually, both of the books, Marjorie Ingalls and Wendy Mogul's, make the argument, I think, that Jewish parenting historically has been about like letting your kids be self-sufficient and giving them freedom. It's sort of anti-helicopter parenting. But the other thing I just want to add is when I think about my own upbringing, which was not highly religious, like we knew Jewish holidays and we did them, and it was definitely, you know, Jewishly proud, but I had cousins who were more religious and people who were less religious. If I think about the, and now I know a billion Jews from, you know, the work we do. What if I think about the common thread, it's that with some exceptions, it is true what the linguist Deborah Tannen says, which is that not only do Jews interrupt each other more, but I think they let their children interrupt them more. And I think the times when I feel most culturally alienated from the goyim, to use the term of art, is when I'm in one of those households where a parent, where a child speaks, and then a parent speaks, and the child stays silent until the, like
no,
that whole thing
this
of like
it makes me uncomfortable. Right. Just hearing about it,
just listening to it.
Nothing is more Christian in a way that makes you think. And I'm being totally blunt here. That makes you think like
then polytest
that person's not going to get to Harvard. Then that sort of polytest that doesn't allow for like real, genuine give and take among equals between children and parents.
And look, if all else fails, just bring up the Holocaust.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
You want ice cream? You know who else wanted food? Children in Auschwitz. It's,
right. Well, you're going to get a B+. The children in Auschwitz would have liked the chance to get a B+.
That's right.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, we will. But we'll, you know, as your kid gets older, you can come back and we'll dispense.
She's leaving the Upper West Side, but she's moving to Kansas.
Sarah Polian Bailey, thank you so much for being our Gentile of the Week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Everyone should get your Washington Post subscription. You should pay for it. Get past the paywall and read Sarah Bailey's piece on Pentecostalism in Brazil. Because of you, I see a light. It's a century, 73 like you. Some strange religion. Some newsletter subscribers this week. We welcome to our newsletter service the law firm of Robert Englund, Ben Goldberg, Emily Bialowis, Frank Yellen, Edward Rustin, and Dr. Buck Rosenberg.
First of all, isn't Robert Englund the guy who played Freddy Krueger?
Yes.
Is he now
spelled,
a listener?
It's spelled differently, but yeah, he is.
If it's you, dude, we love you.
We love you.
Dr. Buck Rosenberg.
Dr. Buck Clifford Rosenberg.
Take it away.
So he originally is from the 25th century. he is a bitter foe of Emperor Ming, right?
I actually thought it was the original name of Buck Rogers, didn't he? That's who he is,
I'm
right?
Confusing with Flash Gordon, I think.
Anyway, it was
Space Avenger.
Yeah, when Buck Rosenberg decided he wanted to zoom into the 25th century, he changed his name to Buck Rogers, but it was really Buck. It's Buck.
Dr. Buck Rosenberg.
Rosenberg.
Anesthesiologist. In space.
He's actually doing my surgery on Friday.
Ear, nose, and throat doctor.
In space.
The newsletter is not the regular tablet newsletter. Oh, no, no. Oh, no, no. This one is written by Scrivener Liel Leibowitz with help from you. To get it, you want to sign up on our website or send an email asking for it to unorthodox@tabletmag.com. You can join us on our new Facebook group. If you go to the Tablet Facebook page and click groups, you can join us. And now we're crowdsourcing some of the newsletter. We might have questions for you and include your answers.
We will.
Oh, we will. So get that newsletter. Hey, it's getting toward the end of the year. So if you want to give money that you can get a tax write-off on, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you that we are tax deductible. So if you go to tabletmag.com and click on donate, you can then give lots of money and you can put a little note saying, make sure this only goes to Unorthodox, which is what God wants you to do. Mazel tovs. Leo, what do you got this week?
I have the English language publication of what I would argue is one of the five greatest Hebrew books written in the modern era. My friend Ruby Namdar's The Ruined House. He's my friend because I read the book in Hebrew and was so floored by it that I wrote him this like very long mesh note, and then discovered he's also a wonderful human being, and that translation is glorious, and you should all read The Ruined House, one of the most meaningful Jewish novels you'll ever read in your life.
How long is it?
It's like 700 pages.
It's thick. It's a big book.
Oh, I was almost there.
No,
with
it's
you.
Like 500. All right. But it's, you know what? But it is both intellectual and carnal. It's a fun book. It's a deep book. It has bits of Talmud like content in the middle. Right. I don't want to ruin any of the surprise.
The Ruined House. Great. Stephanie.
Speaking of important intellectual pursuits, intellectual and carnal, I think you said. Taylor Swift's new album. I am like all about it.
Oh yeah.
This is why we can't have nice things. I'm just like, that's all I got. That's like, that's
your
where I'm at. Is to Taylor.
Is your namesake. Is to
Stephanie Taylor Swift Butnick.
What's her middle name? Is it Stephanie?
Stephanie.
Because it ought to be.
I don't think so. What is her middle name? I don't know. But you know what? She's like the most magical Gentile of all. She was raised on a Christmas tree farm. That's a real story. That is true.
She's the Christian. She's
in the North
the Christmas
Pole.
Fairy.
She's amazing.
Elves,
I love her.
By elves and reindeer.
So yes, my namesake, Taylor Swift.
I have two mazel tovs. First of all, to our guest today, our Jew of the Week, Eddie Portnoy. Who, because the book is amazing. I want to reiterate how and how appropriate a Hanukkah gift the book Bad Rabbi is. But also, he has an event coming up, a book signing with Tablet's own Alana Newhouse. It'll be on Monday, November 20th at 7 p.m. at YIVO, which is at 15 West 16th Street. It's with Alana and with Luke Sant, the writer. So a mazel tov to Eddie again. And then to our listener, Andrew Rowan, who finally mikvah eyes. He dipped. He is a convert. He posted his conversion documents, his bezdin and his mikvah on the Unorthodox Facebook page for like almost 1,000 of the community now on the Facebook
community.
And
everyone's just cheering him
on.
And
we're all cheering him on. And it's like, Andrew, and he's been a letter writer and he's a listener. And
but
Andrew,
you know what they say about conversions, picks or it didn't happen.
Mikvah picks. Mick picks. Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Follow Stephanie Taylor Butnick on Instagram at sbutnick. Join our Facebook group. Our show is produced by Alyssa Goldstein and Shira Talushkin with help from Julia Frakes. We don't say enough about the fine work that our producers do, so at some point we're going to talk more about just how great Alyssa and Shira and Julia are. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our show is edited by Noah A. Levinson. We don't know what the A stands for, but guesses are welcome. Our music is by Golem. Rabbinic supervision this week by our in-house rabbi, Andy Sugarman. If you think your rabbi should be a rabbi of the week, I don't know, write to me at moppenheimer@tabletmag. Kosher slaughtering by Jacob Cinnamon Murphy. He, in fact, has raised chickens from being weak old chicks in the spring, and he just murdered them all. So he, in fact, is a kosher slaughterer. We recorded Argo Studios, which is thinking of getting into the Alabama Senate race as a write-in candidate, and we're proud to be part of the Panoply Network. Shalom, friends.